WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest Ron Powers is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Radio and Television Criticism in 1973 when he wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times. In 1984, Powers followed his urge to visit the small town he grew up in, Hannibal, Missouri. Nationally, that town is best known as the home of Mark Twain. When Powers returned to Hannibal, he found the town caught up in the planning stages of the Mark Twain Sesquicentennial, a celebration of Mark Twain's 150th birthday. With the help of consultants and big bucks, Hannibal would be transformed into a theme park version of itself. The goal was to lure visitors from around the country and revive the town with tourist dollars. Powers was fascinated by this new gaudy caricature of Hannibal and how it compared with the real small town that he remembered. This comparison is the subject of his book White Town Drowsing, Journeys to Hannibal, which has just been published in paperback by Penguin Books. I spoke with Ron Powers earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York, and I asked him why he initially wanted to go back to Hannibal.
Oh, I never stopped wanting to go back ever since I left, which was a long time ago. Back in 1959, I was 17. My father was a Fuller Brush man, and he'd worked those neighborhoods of Hannibal, I guess, for longer than I'd been alive. And he finally decided that there were better times and greater opportunities somewhere else. So he packed us up and moved us away. It was probably not the greatest town to be a grown-up in. If you're trying to make a living and be accountable to all the other people in the town. But for a boy or a girl, I'm sure, it was enchanted. It was just a wonderful little enclave of hills and rivers and good friends and a very ordered, lyric way of life. So I never... It was almost as though my boyhood was sealed off and bottled that summer of 1959. When you're 17, you're just about finished being a child. But that allowed me to remember Hannibal through a child's eyes and not through the harsher and more realistic prism of adulthood. And that's the way I kept the town preserved through all those 25 years between the time I left and the time I started going back.
You know, I think there's two themes that always haunt us from our childhood, either the one of wanting to return to where we're from or wanting to get away from it, depending on what our life circumstances have been.
Exactly. And I guess I missed out on the first part of that. You could probably still find my heel marks in the dirt on the way to Jefferson City if you looked, because I didn't want to leave. It later became obvious to me that it made sense to leave. There was just not very much going on. The 20th century had long since bypassed Hannibal, and I guess I did want to sort of become part of it, and really became a part of the media world that in a strange way came back to invade Hannibal just a couple of years ago, the summer that I started to return.
Yeah, your return to Hannibal coincided with the planning of the Sesquicentennial.
Everybody just called it the Sesquiterry.
The Sesqui, okay, thank you. Well, it was really a sign of the times that in planning this, the whole idea was to exploit history to get the tourist trade.
Exactly. And it was, there were no bad guys in all of this. It wasn't as if there was a corrupt mayor or city council or chamber of commerce, or even the consultants and the marketing experts who came streaming into Hannibal that summer didn't have bad designs in mind. They wanted to prop up a town that, like a lot of river towns, had lost its economy. The railroads were gone. The logs that had floated down the Mississippi to be sawed into lumber had stopped flowing down. Shoe company had left. All that was left, really, for Hannibal was the legacy of that great man and the wish to, in many ways, an authentic wish to celebrate that legacy, but at the same time to make a little money.
Well, the concept was almost to turn all of Hannibal into a Mark Twain theme park.
To make the town a parody of itself. And that, I think, was sort of the original sin. That's what turned around to sort of corrode and cheapen, really, that summer. Turned the town against itself. It became a kind of a tragicomic battle for the soul of a little town. And it was funny because the two halves of my life were sort of at war as I went back and reported this story. The child in me who remembered a town that had an integrity, that had a center, that had patterns that made sense and that I flourished in when I was a kid. Now that town was at sort of doing battle with the things that I had come to understand as a grown-up and as really as a media critic, the forces of market research, the people who come in and hand out questionnaires and say, we know what the consumers want and here's how you can sort of gear it up to gratify them. Logos, sort of brand names, all-purpose amusements. You know, people dressed up like Mark Twain, for instance. People dressed up like jumping frogs in styrofoam frog suits, steamboat races, parades, and that kind of thing. Somewhere the real Mark Twain was getting lost, and the real connection of Hannibal with its mythic history was getting lost. And I was there to sort of watch it happen.
What's great, although the real Mark Twain was getting lost, every Mark Twain impersonator between the Atlantic and the Pacific showed up in Hannibal.
That's true. It was worse than Elvis Presley's imitators. There were guys who wore black Mark Twain suits and didn't smoke cigars because their research had told them that was how he did it. And there were the guys who wore the white Mark Twain suits and did smoke cigars. And they were all sort of baring their teeth at one another, like two guests at a cocktail party who were working on the same dissertation, I guess. And somewhere along the line, I think the humor and the joy of it got lost.
Over $26,000 was spent on a Sesqui video. And I guess the purpose was to advertise all the frivolity on television. But one of the narrative parts, which you quote in your book, is the narrator says, there is really no place in the world like Hannibal, Missouri. Every day is like a chapter in a magical dream. Gosh, I love that copy.
Enough to turn your cheeks green and make your eyes bug out. And really, that's that very kind of hyperbole, that sort of advertising-driven view of Hannibal, has had a damaging effect in the town. School children grow up not consuming Mark Twain as a wonderful storyteller or as a rich source of fantasy. He's a brand name that looks out at them from the back of produce trucks and cheap motels. They don't even teach, or didn't when I left. They weren't teaching Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn in the public school system. Not for political reasons, but because the kids were tired of the image.
Well, in Hannibal's attempt to create this great media image for itself and to turn history into a theme park, here's what I figure happened to you. This story was your big chance to write about something that wasn't media. You know, you return home to your hometown, and you get to a town that's trying to become the TV version of itself.
Bingo. Exactly right, Terry. You asked earlier, a few minutes ago, why I started going back, and I'm not even sure I gave you the real answer. I had a son. He arrived on my 40th birthday, which is now a day away from being 6 years ago. And as soon as he came along, this flood of memories was released in me. I had a strong urge to leave a record for Dean, and now for Kevin, about darkness as opposed to a kind of urban fluorescence, about the way the seasons change, what a rundown ballpark looked and smelled like. And I wanted to let them know where I came from. My father hadn't let me know much about where he came from. So I went back there to do nothing more than to look for memories, and found that the kind of forces that I was writing about as an adult had more or less sort of preceded me to this sacred ground, and that made it such a compelling story in and of itself that I really couldn't turn loose of it.
Ron Powers is my guest, and he's media critic for CBS Sunday Morning, and we're discussing the subject of a book that he wrote called White Town Drowsing, which is about his return to his hometown of Hannibal, Missouri. You know, I live in Philadelphia, and we're no slouches here ourselves in terms of, you know, using history to attract the tourism trade.
Yeah, something happened in Philadelphia once, didn't it?
Yes. And there's many people dressed as Ben Franklin
right.
in this city. But I wonder, what kind of vacationer do you think really wants to go to a place to see people dressed in costumes of the past?
That question is so interesting, and it was really answered by a very smart woman of Hannibal, a woman who'd sort of become my guide through the various political machinations that were going on. She looked around her halfway through this summer of this kind of failed and glitzy celebration, and she said, you know, people come to Hannibal just to touch the way we live. And she was right. I mean, people drive into that town, I think, in search of an American past. And something of the village that Mark Twain wrote about when he talked about the white town drowsing in the sunshine of a summer's morning is still there. The buildings that were up when he was writing those books are up still along the riverfront. And if you have a little patience and can take a little time, you can find the ancient charm of an American village. So that, I think, is what was getting lost.
You met with the consultant who put this package together.
Mm-hmm.
Did he strike you as a cynical kind of guy? Do you think the consultants who package this kind of stuff are, on the whole, pretty cynical about tourists and vacationers?
I think that cynicism is a real hazard of the consulting mentality. That is not to say that people who go by the numbers and who believe in behaviorist research are necessarily cynical. But what they give up, and I think what this guy encouraged Hannibal to give up, was the spontaneous voice, the sense of intuition, the sense that the kind of faith in metaphor and an imagery that really propelled Mark Twain to write his books. Mark Twain didn't do any market research before he brought Huckleberry Finn into the world. And I think that these people are, I think that really the whole country, if you think about politics, television news, even education, the kinds of textbooks that are selected and printed, we have abandoned our sense of what is right from the intuitive voice almost wholesale to the consulting mentality, and it's produced a kind of an artificial overlay over the whole popular culture.
Well, an easy example of this is that the consultant who organized all this is from New York.
Yes.
What does he know about Hannibal?
Used to be Patton's
small
public
town
relations.
Life.
Used to be Patton's public relations man.
Oh, gosh.
Truly. Yeah.
How did the final celebration and the amount of people who turned out for it compare to what the dream was supposed to be?
Sort of like the last pages of Araby, that wonderful James Joyce story of the boy who finally makes it to the bazaar when it's closing down and the lights are going off. It really would have been a decent enough celebration if that had been all they promised the people of Hannibal. I mean, they had some parades and they had a rock concert and they had some really nice historical moments. But the memory of these sort of Byzantine dreams that had been spun out, this sort of glittering pleasure dome on the Mississippi that would thrust Hannibal back into the 20th century in an almost Disney World kind of way, were still lingering. And that tarnished and provided a kind of bittersweet counterpoint to what really happened. I guess the crowning blow was that on November 30th, 1985, which would have been Mark Twain's 150th birthday, Hal Holbrook, who has made a terrific career doing his Mark Twain impressions, was to have been there for the gala closed-down celebration. He finally sort of, I think he must have gotten wind of all the things that were going wrong, wrote a letter and said, sorry, other commitments, I can't make it. So that was really the final blow. Except for the book, which, by the way, I was happy that the people of Hannibal felt warmly toward the book. A lot of newspapers and magazines had blown through town and done some articles that were satirical, and I think the people felt a little exposed and a little humiliated. But I think they sensed the goodwill in the book itself, and I was very happy for that.
Well, you were reverent about the town. It's just the celebration that you,
exactly.
You thought was strange. You know, when your book came out, reviewers and publicity drew comparisons to Garrison Keillor because this is about a small town. And with all due respect to Garrison Keillor, who's absolutely wonderful, did that drive you crazy?
You know, there wasn't that much. It did come up in a few articles. I don't think the Times or the New Yorker or some of the other papers really drew that comparison. I agree with you, boundless respect is due to Garrison Keillor. I mean, he really has brought back a way of American storytelling about its roots that I think has just been gone too long. He's absolutely masterful. But these were real people, and the stakes were real. And while it wasn't a life or death story that was being told, it was a story that really gets to the heart of of whether we, really, whether small towns have an economic future. Do they? I mean, it seems to me that American towns are in terrible, terrible trouble. And what do you do when a town runs out of money? You don't tear down the buildings and crate them up and put them in some kind of storage set. You have to go on living. And I think that the decisions that the town fathers and the Chamber of Commerce people and the citizens of Hannibal were making that summer are being replicated all around the country. It's real. And I think that's what separated my book from a kind of a happy storytelling kind of approach.
You know, I have to say, in reading your book, I found myself thinking about Dolly Parton. Let me explain.
Please do.
This is I was watching her show last Sunday, and I thought, well, that is, in for me, a just kind of really cynical version of what you've been talking about. And what I mean is that on her show, she's always paying homage to her small town roots and her working class background with these great, great big production numbers, you know. And she's even built a theme park to herself.
Dollywood.
Yeah. And I just find it remarkable.
Yes. That's true. I mean, you can find it, Civil War battlefields, historic districts in Midwestern towns. What we have done, really, Terry, is we have leapt almost unconsciously into the television idiom of reducing and simplifying a concept or an idea and turned it into a logo. That is what I think goes on, these examples that we've been mentioning, and I think it was in danger of happening in Hannibal. And Mark Twain, yes, he was probably a kindly, avuncular man who told pleasant stories about boys painting fences, but he was also a dark and dangerous prophet of the 20th century in terms of religion and warfare and capitalism. He had disturbing things to say that ought still to be heard, and that is the Mark Twain that I think that we have been in danger of losing.
My guest is Ron Powers, and we're talking about his book, White Town Drowsing, which is about his return to Hannibal, Missouri. Ron Powers is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning media critic, and we're going to talk about his work as a journalist and media critic in just a few seconds. But first, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ron Powers is my guest. Let's talk about your career with newspapers and television.
Mm-hmm.
When you started writing about television, were you assigned to it, or did you want that beat?
I wanted it. Well, I wanted a column. This was back in the last days of the front page era of Chicago newspaper life, back in the early and mid-70s, when the town still had four dailies, and there was a newspaper culture, and you could be a star if you had a byline, and there was still a lot of emphasis on style. Individual writing, people like Roger Ebert and Bob Green and all these guys were cutting their teeth in newspaper journalism. And I was just blown in from St. Louis, where I'd been writing high school sports and county government meetings, and I thought, this is my chance. So the television column became available, and I said, I'd sure like to have that, please. And they said, okay. But the interesting thing about that era was that the four critics who were writing in Chicago were all, I think, all terrific. And we were just starting to change the whole focus and purpose of the television column. It had been, up until then, sort of an offshoot of the nightclub beat. There were nice pieces about tonight's programs and what Susie Starlet is doing and the primetime strategies. We were turning it into a consumer issue. These were the years of the tag end, really, of the counterculture. Action for Children's Television was getting going in Boston. Michael Arlen was covering the Vietnam War through the prism of television and comparing it to the actual sensibilities of what it was like in the field. And we realized that we were on to a branch of journalism that had as much power and as much influence as the op-ed page or the editorial columns, and we tried to write it like that.
Was that your interest, that consumer angle? Because I figure if you didn't own a TV, you probably weren't that interested in television programs.
Well, it was easy, you know, to do a little reading about some of the good writing that was done in television. You could very quickly get excited about it. And certainly there was a large constituency. I was astonished at the amount of, and the intensity of letters that I would get after a column came out. So you had the sense that it was an sort of an untouched nerve that we the four critics in Chicago who were writing, started touching, and it became a very gratifying and exciting thing to write about.
You left Chicago newspapers to work for CBS Television on CBS Sunday Morning. Did you start seeing TV differently once you started working in it?
Well, I really left newspapers to write a lot of famous novels and emerge from the Connecticut woods and get the National Book Award every year. That didn't happen, Terry. I don't know why, but it didn't. So I started freelancing in television. And sure, of course, your perspective changes. There's a lot of virtuosity that goes into being a good television performer that is almost impossible to understand when you're on the other side of the screen. I mean, to take one handy example, my colleague on Sunday Morning, Charles Kuralt, everybody knows him as avuncular and gentle and sensitive toward the rhythms of America. What they don't realize is that he's a frighteningly good user of that television camera and microphone. The way he can read from a teleprompter consistently a line a second so that the director in the booth can bring up natural sound from a soundtrack and know that Charles won't intrude on it with his voice. The way he signals a sort of change of thought or a change of mood in his delivery with an almost operatic, subtle shift of an octave, a half note. And that kind of awareness, which is almost impossible. It's like learning a backhand. Man was not meant to learn to hit a backhand. Man was not meant to learn to do television. Some people do it extraordinarily well.
I guess what I'm wondering is this when you're reviewing television on television, is it possible to keep your journalistic distance?
I try. I do, and I try not very hard not to become an advocate. I try to distance myself from the corporation that is CBS, and I think I've been pretty successful about that. I mean, I don't think I could be totally objective about Sunday Morning because I identify with the program and I'm very proud of it and I make no pretenses about it. But as for the rest of the strategies and the practices of television news, what CBS is doing in prime time, or really even the ancient competition between television and the print world, I think I'm pretty objective about that because, for one thing, I work in both. And I'm sort of horrified, really, at what I think is one of the ongoing stories of the 1980s, the degree to which broadcasting has sort of colonized the world of print and created a new kind of magazine and newspaper imitator that has all of the characteristics, the brevity, the color, the obsession with data, the lack of context that makes it a kind of freeze-dried television. And as a person who likes the written word and appreciates good storytellers and good writers, I think this is a dangerous trend.
Are you talking about magazines that pay more attention to graphics than they do to the articles? Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Sure. People, the Gannett approach to newspapering, USA Today, I mean, they certainly try not to say, Gannett is not saying we want to replace the New York Times, we want to be a supplement. But they've had shockwaves that have extended into the New York Times, I think. The creation of the living section, the whole shift from ideas to personalities, I think, has been generated by the onslaught of the broadcast idiom.
Well, with that said, I think I have to ask you the real tough question, Ron Powers. What are your favorite shows of this season?
There's a new season? Well, let's see. I like Slap Maxwell. I think that's a lot of fun. It's a terrific show. I love the writing in it. I like the wonderful character who is so pompous and vain and so deliciously out of it that he becomes almost endearing. I relish that show. I'm fascinated with, well, you know, I sort of like to dial around. I'm sort of like most consumers when I watch. I sit there with the console on my lap and the 36 buttons, and if I'm not stimulated every 6 or 7 seconds, I hit something else. So I'm probably a terrible example of somebody to ask. My 6-year-old is developing very bad habits.
Well, you mentioned you have a 6-year-old. I think you have 2 sons.
Right.
And now that there are children of television watching age in the house, Do you feel differently about watching television? Do you try to limit their television watching? I always wonder how TV critics handle this.
Well, I've learned from them. I really have learned from them. I used to hear television critics who were parents say that, and I used to say, come on. But you do. You learn that they pick up the secondary messages of television, the sort of the social values and biases that commercials generate, for instance, when there's an old grandfatherly type who represents real orange juice and the smart young kids are the frozen orange juice. Well, my six-year-old feels sorry for the grandfatherly type, and he's right. Also, in terms of limiting it, both my wife and I have made it a practice almost since birth to read aloud to the children. We rather than tell them, no, don't watch, we just have storybooks as a presence in the living room and in the kids' room at night. And that's kind of a charming way to go about it.
Do you enjoy bad television? Really bad.
Oh, I guess I do. I'm sort of interested in the new wave of television talk shows now that they finally found a way to bring the TV talk show into the 21st century, and that is to release the audience as a kind of an attack dog on the guest. And I'm sort of charting this and watching it, and there's a new kind of tabloid frenzy that's getting into news shows that aren't produced by the networks. We have tabloid news, gossip news, all kinds of, post-entertainment tonight kinds of approaches to journalism, and it's fun and a little bit horrifying to track.
Do you watch Entertainment Tonight?
Don't ask.
Why not?
I gave up an interview with them to come here, Terry.
Did you really?
No.
Then I'm not even flattered.
Sure, I watch.
I love the way they've made celebrity stuff into the news format. It's wonderful.
Yeah, exactly.
So, actually, we're out of time. Let me just ask you, how much TV do you have to watch for the job, and how much do you watch as a civilian?
Well, I find that I watch a lot for the job, but I spend a lot of time on the telephone. I try to get to know the people in the industry. I found that my reading time has increased as I try to take account of the real world so I can compare it to what's going out on the screen. But definitely watch more than I used to, and I sometimes feel strange when I go to a movie for recreation and find that I can't change channels if I'm not enjoying what I'm seeing.
Oh, boy.
I was just kidding about that.
I know what you mean, though. Ron Powers, thank you so much talking with us. I've been speaking with Ron Powers, who is the media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He has also written a book about his hometown of Hannibal, Missouri, and about his recent return there, and it's called White Town Drowsing, and it's just been published in paperback by Penguin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.